Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, so here's a couple of things we're going to do in this series. We're going to tonight is going to be like an introduction, an overview of the concepts. And then we're going to get into three major areas, and maybe more, depending on what you lead me to. We're going to talk about the responsibility as it applies to community, and we're going to talk about it as it applies to parenting, or let's just say family relationships, primarily parenting, but really any family relationships. And we're going to talk about responsibility as it applies to finances. And obviously all of this through a Jewish lens, through how we're informed by the Torah as to what the Jewish perspective would be. So we're going to do a couple things. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to identify, all right, I'll use the word ID, we're going to identify the Jewish notion of responsibility, which means we're going to look at the Torah, we're going to look at how responsibility plays a role, a significant role, and we're going to demonstrate that the whole concept of responsibility is a basic thing. Then I'd like you to get an idea of what we believe happens to a person when they take on being responsible. What happens when you're responsible? As opposed to if you're not responsible. In other words, are you just a good guy or a good gal if you're responsible? And if you're not responsible, then you're just a bad guy? Or does it make a difference? Does it make a difference in your life? And then I want to cover why you'd want to be responsible. What's in it for you? Okay. Why would you want to be responsible? Of course, we really have to know what we're talking about when we talk about responsibility. So let's go through a couple things here and see if we can kind of develop an idea of responsibility. There's a word in Hebrew that I'm going to be using a lot. So let me define that word now. The reason I use this word is because I first encountered the concept of responsibility through the Hebrew word called achrayus. Or actually in modern Hebrew it would be achrayut. Achrayut. And those of you who can read Hebrew, it would be aleph, chet, resh, yud, taf, achrayut. Or in, what do you call these square letters? Square letters? Yeah, cursive. What was the other one? Black letters? France or something like that. Yeah, there's another word. Achrayut. Or achrayus. We like to mispronounce it as achrayus. And achrayus really captures the whole body of the attitude that a Jew has when indeed he deals with the issue of achrayus. When I use that word achrayus, I mean something very close to responsibility. We'll try to define that a little bit. So, first of all, does anybody know the first incident where responsibility or not being responsible plays a role in human history?
Gan Eden.
Gan Eden, yeah, we're in Gan Eden, but that's even before Cain and Hevel. We're going to get to Cain and Hevel. That's early enough, but that's not as far back as it goes. So we're in Gan Eden. We're in Gan Eden. You mean... Yeah, it's a das. Yeah, yes.
I think of after they recognized they were naked, then Adam made clothes of fig leaves for him and his wife.
Yeah, actually, it might actually be God who did that, but okay. But first of all, we have a Kadosh Baruch Hu saying to Adam, I am placing you here, la'avda'u l'shamra, to be responsible, to work it and to guard it. So first of all, Adam is put in charge of the whole Gan Eden. That's number one. Maybe that's what you meant. Then, before Shabbos, right, Adam is created on Friday at noon, and then by Friday night, he's already messed things up. Before Shabbos, he and Chava eat from the Eitz Hadas, and when HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to hold them accountable, Adam comes up with the first of countless excuses that models what it is for a person to rebel against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The model. And here's a person who has just violated the instruction that he was given. The only prohibition that he had was, don't eat from this tree, do anything else you want. Eat from the rest of the garden, but from this tree don't eat. And he ate from that tree. So God says, did you eat from this tree? So he says, the woman that you placed with me, she gave it to me and I ate. Right? So immediately, besides the fact, the unbelievable lack of gratitude for the partner in his existence, is given. That's one issue. The other issue is he doesn't answer, yes, I ate from the tree that you told me not to. He says something other than yes or no. One way you can always know if you're not being responsible for something is if you don't say yes or no. If the answer to a question is something other than yes or no, what it means is that somehow you're dealing with something other than being responsible. You'll notice that in the question. If anybody who you care about asks you a question that has to do with whether you did something or not, you either did or you didn't. And all the other stuff may be relevant, but that comes after you say yes or you say no. So Adam doesn't say no. He says, the woman that you gave me. So that's the ultimate irresponsibility. And it's very informative because this is the first violation and this is the first communication of a human being caught in the act of not doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, and the first thing he does is shift responsibility. And then we move on to Cain and Hevel, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Cain after he murders his brother, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, where is Hevel, your brother? Now we're dealing here with someone who is great enough to receive divine communication. Cain is not a slouch. He is a very special person who has achieved prophecy. Whether he's achieved it or whether he started that way, whatever it is, he's on the level of being able to actually hear words from God. Not like we who are inspired sometimes by a notion of what we think God wants, but a real communication. God says words that enter his ears and his mind, and they're specific words. So Cain is a very holy man. Right? It's an amazing thing. It's hard for us to absorb that. But Cain is special enough to be able to hear from God. There are very few people in the world who are not tzaddikim who hear from God. As a matter of fact, Bilam is one who ends up hearing from God, and he's a pretty decadent kind of a fellow. At the same time, he also has prophecy. You know, we have to deal with that question some other time. But Cain hears from God, and while he's talking to God, he's talking to the King of Kings, he's talking to his own grandfather in a more literal sense than anybody else, because he knows his father has no father. He knows his father came into being because God brought him into being. Right? God says, where is Hevel, your brother? And he says to God, Hashomer Achi Anochi, am I the protector and the guardian of my brother? Again, the unbelievable evasion of achrayus, of responsibility. And the Medrash goes through a very elaborate interpretation of what Cain says, including the idea that the word Anochi that Cain uses, Cain is referring to God. He's saying, Hashomer Achi, am I my brother? Am I my brother? Anochi you who call yourself Anochi Hashem Elokecha, the first word in the Aseret HaDibros, which identifies you, you're responsible for the death of Hevel because you didn't accept my sacrifices, says the Medrash that Cain says to God. So here he is caught in the act, literally red-handed, and he's saying, you're responsible, not me. Right? So that's really the source of Averus, is the human capacity to avoid responsibility. Moving on in history, so then we have someone who really lives out responsibility to the nth degree. Did you know that Noach doesn't sleep in the Teva? Because he and his family have got to be on an unusual cycle of feeding the animals, and not all the animals ate on schedule. If you think raising twins are difficult, you can imagine what it would be like to raise the entire table of species, and they all eat at different times. And so the point is that Noah was charged with the responsibility of maintaining the entire universe, right? Which was all condensed into this miraculously, into this ark. It's very interesting because everything about the Teva was a miracle. The dimensions of the Teva have absolutely no relationship whatsoever with its capacity to hold the animals that the Torah claims are in there. 2x2 and 7x7, it's ridiculous. You can't get that many animals into a box that's described with the dimensions of the Teva. It was a miracle, right? Nachmanides and others go through the whole discussion of why even bother with a box, because this box was a miracle. You could have put them in a suitcase, right? You know, you could have put the whole world in a suitcase. But after all those miracles, there wasn't a miracle in feeding the animals. Noach and his family have to feed all the animals in a natural way. They don't get to sleep while God says, don't worry, I'll take care of it, or they won't be hungry, or I'll make sure the food just appears in their cages or whatever it is. They have to do that. Why? One of the reasons is because Noach is charged with the responsibility of restoring the notion of achrayus, of responsibility, that there's got to be the idea that human beings are responsible for God's world. So part of the tikkun, part of the repair that's involved in the flood, as God wipes out the world as he knew it and as it was until Noah, he recreates a whole different paradigm of responsibility. That's one of the major issues in the Teva. So Noah lives out major responsibility. And our sources tell us that Noah was actually held accountable, because when God says to him, I'm about to wipe out the entire world with a flood, the Medrash says that Noah says, and what's going to be with me? Right? Now, what kind of response is that? Why doesn't he respond and say, you, what? You're going to wipe out the entire world? God, you made the world. What can I do to stop it? Similar to what Abraham Avinu does with Sodom, when they're known to be evil. And Abraham intercedes and begs and pleads and negotiates a deal, all the way down to a few possible tzaddikim. Noach doesn't do that. So Noach is therefore made ultimately responsible for the survival of the whole world that's enclosed in the Teva, to repair that. Then come the forefathers, the Avos. So the forefathers are the Merkava, the traveling, moving vehicle through which the Shekhinah operates in the world. The divine presence brought into the world through the Avos. Avraham Avinu, the first of the forefathers, is known as Av Hamon Goyim, the father of a multitude of nations. And Avraham Avinu is infamous. I'm not going to say infamous. He's developed, I mean, his whole approach, not infamous, he's famous for, let's say, his sense of responsibility for the whole world. Right? This case of Sodom, where he begs God for some way of sparing this evil city of Sodom, where Avraham Avinu sets up his whole household in a way that everybody has to pass through him because he wants to make sure to make a difference to them. He takes ultimate responsibility for the world. We go on through Chumash, we can look at Yosef. Yosef has an amazing moment when he's about to sin with the wife, the mistress of the household, and Yosef says, how could I sin when my master has trusted me with everything in his household, and I would sin against him and against God? And by that he means that the level of responsibility that I've assumed, that I've been given by my master, by my human master, and also by God who entrusted me with all this. I can't go against that. Achrayus, that's the ultimate responsibility. I can't violate that. Yehuda. Yehuda is famous for the level of responsibility that he takes. Yehuda, in a certain sense, is the first Baal Tshuva when he's confronted with the fact that Tamar is pregnant from him, and Tamar, according to everybody else's limited knowledge, has conceived inappropriately, and he's sitting in judgment of Tamar. He says, Tzadka mi meni. He says publicly, Tzadka, she's righteous, me many. It's for me. And he confesses his sin and takes full responsibility for that. Yehuda, later on, when Yaakov is debating what to do about the vulnerability of Binyamin going down to Mitzrayim, so Reuven says, I'll take care of him. Don't worry about it. And Rashi says that Yaakov turns to Reuven and says, you're a Bechor Shota. You're a silly firstborn. That you're saying that you're going to use your own children as security for Binyamin. Why would you do such a thing? Because when you think your children don't matter to me, you're going to say your kids will be security for my Binyamin? You think that? I had a teacher, by the way, in fourth grade. It's amazing. Fourth grade for me was over 45 years ago, and I remember it like yesterday. I never got over it. I'm a firstborn son, and I don't know what this teacher had against me. Maybe he didn't. I made up that he had something against me. But he says to me, you see, Rashi says that a Bechor is a Shota, because Rashi says Bechor is Shota. Right? And so I was terribly offended. I can't believe it. Why am I a Shota? What did I do to deserve that? So here I am, many years later, still remembering what might have been a joke. I don't know why he had to do that. Anyway, the point is, so Reuven tries to guarantee that he'll take care of Binyamin. Yaakov doesn't take it. Yehuda steps forward and he says to Yaakov, I will guarantee it. And Yaakov says, okay. And indeed, Yehuda goes down, and by Yigashay love Yehuda. Yehuda is the one who approaches Yosef and says, take me as a servant. Take me as a servant. Why did Yaakov listen to Yehuda and not to Reuven? And the answer is that there was something in Yehuda's taking of responsibility which was so total and so forceful that it created a whole different dynamic. Yaakov knew instantly Yehuda's word would make a difference. When Reuven said it, he meant it, but it wasn't the full level of achrayus. It wasn't the full level of responsibility that Yehuda did, and therefore Reuven doesn't win the day. Yehuda, again, when he says to his brothers, when Yosef is in the pit, he says to them, Ma betza, the naharoga zachina, what gain is there for us to kill our brother? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. Now, you have to understand that this is Yehuda who sat together with his brothers and actually ruled according to halacha as they knew it, that Yosef was guilty enough to be put to death. This was not some trivial sibling rivalry thing. We're talking about grown men, huge, huge righteous people, and there was a major division and an approach to how to serve God and how to form the Jewish people. They knew what Yaakov was, their father was, and here they felt that there was a Yosef who was really a threat to the health of the Jewish people, and they sit as a Beis Din and they rule that he needs to be killed. Then they're going to cover up the fact that they're killing him. So Yehuda says, Ma betza, what's the point of killing him? So Rashi says that Yehuda's argument was, if we're going to cover it up, that means we're not taking responsibility for the decision that we made. If we can't live with it enough to say, yes, we killed him because he deserved to be killed, then there's something wrong with this and we can't do it. So therefore we have to be able to be responsible, and if we can't be responsible, we can't do it. An act has to be done with total culpability and total responsibility. So Yehuda epitomizes the notion of responsibility to the point where the Medrash says, there's a long discussion in the Medrash. The Medrash says, do you know why Yehuda merits becoming the royal tribe? Why is Yehuda the source of royalty? Because of all these events that I described, because of his taking of achrayus, because of his willful acceptance of responsibility in different areas, both in his own personal life as well as in the life of the Jewish people. There are other cases as well. Yes.
But he still covered it up.
He didn't kill him.
I know they covered up that he killed So he didn't take responsibility.
That's a good question. Peyton, you got me. That's a good question. Yehuda still participates in some form of a cover-up. Got to deal with that. Good question.
Is it Teshuva that he did, you know, when he went and said to Yosef, put me in jail and let my brother, you know, swap me for my brother? So was that being responsible?
It was, but ultimately...
Did that make amends for when he wasn't?
But, I mean, if you're talking about... But, I mean, if as I say, he understands that not being able to stand tall with the decision is an evasion of responsibility, so being responsible somewhere else doesn't necessarily compensate for it over here. Got to really work that out. I have to look at that. Okay. Now, look at Moshe Rabbeinu. The emergence of Moshe as the savior of the Jewish people, the emissary for the salvation of the Almighty for the Jewish people. So, first of all, Vayigdal Ha'ish, Moshe grows up in Pharaoh's palace, Vayetze El Achav, and he went out to his brethren. And Rashi says there on the spot, Nasan Einav V'libo Lihios Meitzar Aleim. He went out to his brethren, I'm sorry, it says Vayetze El Achav, he went out to his brethren, Vayar V'siv Lasam, and he saw their suffering. So the way the Hebrew is structured, Rashi notices that it's more than just he was taking a walk and he noticed something. You know, he just happened to encounter something going on. But Nasan Eina V'libo Liyas Meitzar Aleim, he specifically went out in order to notice so that he could become disturbed for their fight. So Moshe Rabbeinu is of the stuff that he actually wants to know what's going on with his brethren. He actually wants to be bothered by it. He could have avoided it. He could have stayed within the palace. But Nasaneina Valiba Lias Mecharlaim, he specifically goes out to be responsible. Later on, he's shepherding the flock for Yisro, which itself, the Medrash says, is one of the signs that he's qualified to lead the Jewish people, because he's taking care of these sheep, and there's one little sheep that runs away, and he's worried about that one little sheep. And Moshe Rabbeinu bothers himself physically to be able to go after the sheep. And as he's going after the sheep, there's this bush that's burning and it's not consumed. And it says, Moshe says, Asura nava er'eh, let me go off my path and see, Madua lo yivar hasneh, why won't the bush burn? So the passage says, Vayar Hashem kisar le'os, God saw that he deviated from his path in order to see. So the Medrash says that Moshe's perplexity about the bush burning and not being consumed, Moshe's trying to understand the nature of the Jewish people. How could they be suffering so much and yet they're still here? I don't get it. What's the nature of this people that I'm a part of? That they're suffering so much in Egypt, there's this fire in it, but it's not consumed. Vayar Hashem kisar le'os, God saw that he deviated in order to see. His curiosity, his sense of accountability for this, he had to find out. He wasn't just going to pass it by. It's somebody else's problem. He was preoccupied with it. Therefore, God appears to him and speaks to him from the theme when God saw that he moved. So, if I'll just give a short survey. Adam, Cain, Noach, the forefathers, Yehuda, Yosef, Moshe. Just a brief survey. We could go into this in great, great detail to find the theme of responsibility making a huge difference, actually making the difference in the course of human history. Adam HaRishon, his first sin, the rebellion against God, at its source is my fault. And Cain, the first murder, it's your fault. And then leadership coming from a willful burdening, a willful taking on of the burden of responsibility. As a matter of fact, we could say that to be responsible really is to be fully developed as a human being. Being responsible, to accept achrayus, is really to be a fully developed human being. It's really a way of emulating God. And this is the whole idea of a human being created the tzelem elokim, in the image of God. What does it mean that man is created in the image of God? What we mean by that is that man is given the attributes that mirror the nature of God. If we understand the nature of man, we'll actually have access to understanding the nature of God himself. So it doesn't mean that man looks like God. It means that man is given many of the characteristics of the divine being. such as choice, initiative, that a human being alone among all creatures in the world is actually able to, from nothing, choose what he or she is going to do. Right? It's not that everything that we do is caused by something. There's no instinct that makes us do what we do. Certainly we have instincts. I'm not saying we don't have instincts. But I can actually choose to walk over here, and it's not a result of some kind of imprinting that comes from, well, in my case, it does, comes from my father, you know, but in most normal people, you know, it's not a result of some kind of instinctive thing, you know what I'm saying? We have choice. We can initiate. We can make, that reflects God. Being responsible, taking responsibility for the world, taking responsibility for something outside of me, is actually a reflection of the divine nature. And actually is a fulfillment of the purpose of creation itself, which is to know God. So when a human being acts responsibly, when a human being actually assumes responsibility, he's actually fulfilling the purpose of creation itself. But it goes further than that. It really goes to the core of what a human being is. There's a fascinating Gemara in Tractate Bava Basra that talks about when a person is qualified to testify about a sale of property and when he's not. If you don't get these details, well, it's okay. But if I sell you a piece of property and I don't accompany the sale with a guarantee, which means that if later on we find out that I had a creditor and I owed a ton of money and I don't have any other way of paying it, then that creditor can go to you and say, Bert, you bought a piece of property from Elon Feldman. He owed me money. That was the last thing I could have seized. You should have known that this was property that was to pay a debt, and give it to me. And he can draft it, right? So the Talmud says that I am not qualified to testify about that sale. Why? Because I might lie. Because I might want to claim that that property is still available for paying off the debt that I had. Why? Because, says the Gemara, Avad Lava Li Ishmava, there's a passage that says that a borrower is internally indebted to the creditor, and therefore I'll do anything to make sure that the person who lent me money is paid off. So one of the Talmudic authorities asked the following question. You mean I'll lie so that I can pay off the debt? I'm such a moral person that I want to pay off my debt that you don't trust me. I'm going to end up lying about the property under oath in Beis Din so that I can pay off my debt. So it's an amazing thing, but I'm not. So the answer is yes, because it's a basic human nature to feel a sense of obligation. And a person would rather lie and commit a terrible violation rather than not pay off an obligation. So there's a certain sense of accountability that we all have ingrained in us, and it's part of the tzuras ha'adam, part of the image of a human being that we have. Remember the Mishnah in Avos, where Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai says to his students, "Go out and tell me what is the evil attribute that a person should distance himself from the most." So the different rabbis come back with different answers. They go out and they check it out, and Rabbi Eliezer says, Ayin Ra, with an evil eye, which means somebody who just cannot stand anybody else gaining anything. He says that's the worst kind of attitude for a person to have, an Ayin Ra. Rabbi Yeshua says, Chaver Ra, a bad friend. That's the worst thing in the world, to have somebody, to be associated with somebody who has evil attributes and evil behaviors. Rabbi Yossi says, Shachen Ra, an evil neighbor, just being around in an environment of evil rubs off on you, and therefore that's the worst thing in the world. Rav Shimon says, no, one who borrows and doesn't pay back, that's the worst thing in the world. Says Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, I see the words of Rav Shimon more than anybody else. Rav Shimon's idea of someone who borrows and doesn't pay back, that's the worst. So Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, who has a couple of essays on this topic of responsibility, points out that's how far it goes, because a person who borrows and doesn't pay back is really somebody who has lost his sense of humanity altogether. He's degraded himself to the point where he loses a basic human trait, and that would be worse than these other people in terms of attitude. Now, this Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, I just want to mention, he was the Rosh Hashiva of the Mir Yeshiva until he passed away in 1980. I had the privilege of actually studying with him and attending a weekly, what we call a chabura, which is some kind of a presentation around a dining room table of about six or seven guys. And you had to get special permission to come, and it was a whole thing, and I didn't deserve to come, but I used Protexia. I knew somebody who knew somebody, and it was just an amazing thing. This man was an unbelievably besides the fact that he had a photographic mind, I mean, he literally never forgot a thing he saw in his life, which, okay, that's nothing. I mean, if he has it, he has it. It's not his fault. He doesn't get credit for it, right? No, but he didn't develop it. He didn't train for that. And okay. But the fact is, he was immersed in Torah study day and night his entire life. This is a man who, by eyewitness accounts, reliable accounts, used to set himself up in the Beis Medrash with a fender that would only stay up if he held it up. He was afraid that he would fall asleep from exhaustion. And so the reports were that the dorm, which was right under the Beis Medrash, every little while, every 20 minutes or so, would hear a loud thump. Because he had fallen asleep, the thing had fallen over, and then he set it up again in such a way. This is a man who was just unbelievably diligent, but not only in his Torah study, in his character development. He was an amazing, amazing, humble, loving, sensitive human being who at age 80-something, after a stroke, would stand in front of hundreds of people, including, you know, we're talking about 40- and 50-year-old students. We're talking about some seriously developed people here. And he would stand up there and deliver a talk and just weep openly in front of us from emotion. Anyway, so I heard him give this talk on Achrayus. That's why I say I use this word, because he introduced that word to me. And Rav Chaim would talk, I heard him tell you this twice during the year that I was there, he would talk about the transformation that would occur to a human being who undertook Achrayus. His whole point was, here's what happens. Somebody comes to you and says, will you take this job? And you say, no, I don't have time, right? So you're really right, you don't have time, right? But somebody does say yes, and they don't have time either, right? But what happens is, Rav Chaim would point out, that with the acceptance of Achrayus comes an expansion of your capacity. When a person accepts responsibility, then he actually gets a totally different definition from above of who he is and what he's capable of. So a person should never say no based on who he is at the moment, because by definition, by stepping into something, he gets divine assistance that's commensurate with the level of responsibility that he's taken. You know the famous statement that a chassan is forgiven for all of his sins on the day of his wedding? So that happens to be derived from the most unlikely of sources. You know the source for the concept that a groom is forgiven for his sins on the day of his wedding? What are you laughing about, Ezra?
It comes from Esav.
It comes from Esav, exactly. Esav marries this woman named Machlas, and her name really isn't Machlas, her name is really Basmas, and the Gemara says, why do they call her Machlas, this evil woman? So he says, because when he married her, he was forgiven for all his sins. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, Esav was forgiven for all the sins. He didn't do tshuva or anything. He didn't repent. Why is he forgiven? Rechaim says that's the level of response that's the level of divine assistance that you get when you take responsibility. A person who gets married is assuming responsibility for another human being. At that point, he's given a clean slate, right? He's wiped clean. He's given more powers, more abilities, and he goes on and on and documents different indications and sources about that. Okay, so it kind of answers a little bit about why you want to be responsible. The reason you want to be responsible is because you actually want to earn divine assistance. You actually want to earn the merit of being responsible for a piece of God's world. But here's a really important point. I actually gave away this whole talk in a sermon that I gave about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Who was here when I talked about the $600 accident that I had when I... Okay, there were 3 or 4 of you. Okay, so I'll repeat it very quickly for the benefit of those of you who were sleeping or who weren't there. Because this, to me, really encapsulates a concept which is really, really important. And that is the difference between being responsible and being obligated. We don't need the whole story. I hit somebody, I was going 2 miles an hour, it ended up costing me $600 and two different visits to traffic court and waiting on the scene of the terrible accident for about 2 hours when I was terribly, terribly pressured. So I had a lot of costs. And at first, I was relating to this thing as this is absolutely stupid, this is unbelievable, I shouldn't have to do this, and so on and so forth. So at that point, I realized I was obligated. I was absolutely obligated by virtue of the fact that I was driving a car that was moving and it hit another car. I was obligated for whatever, you know, whatever the damages were. But I wasn't at all responsible. I was thinking that I wasn't driving my car, the brakes aren't as tight as on my car, therefore the car was moving, it shouldn't have been moving, I really was pressing hard enough on the brakes. These teenage drivers really don't need to call their father, they really don't need to go to a place to get it assessed, why can't you just, you know, whatever. You can't even see the damage, it's underneath the bumper or whatever it is, and okay, and whether I shouldn't be here, I shouldn't even be driving right now, this is somebody else's fault, I'm doing somebody else a favor, this is stupid, right? Everything but I hit that car and I want to take care of the result of what I did, right? That's called being obligated, not being responsible, right? Being responsible is that when I do something, I actually hold myself accountable. And I actually want to be responsible for my actions. I don't want to avoid the consequences of my actions. There's a famous question that the authorities ask about two sources in our tradition. We're familiar with at least one of them. Everybody's familiar with the famous statement that the children of Israel utter at the foot of Mount Sinai in order to accept Torah. Nasa v'nishma. They say, all that God says, we will do and we will listen. Gemara says that when God heard the Jews respond to the overture for Torah with Nasa v'nishma, he said, Mi gila roz zos, who revealed to human beings this secret language, lashon malachi hasharis mishtam shabo, a language that only the angels on high know how to use. And the Gemara quotes a passage which indicates that performance always comes before understanding. And they understood the sequence of Nasa and then Nishma. How did they get that? Well, okay, that's a very beautiful statement of voluntary commitment that the children of Israel undertook in order to enter into the relationship of Torah. However, there's another source about the very same moment, which says, it says they stood under the mountain. Says the Gemara, Kafa aleihem har kegigis. He held Mount Sinai over their heads like a barrel. And he said, if you accept the Torah, fine. If not, Shum tehek v'rasam. This will be where you are buried. Right? So you will be buried under the mountain. So did they have a choice? Not at all. Did they say Nasa v'nishma? Yes. So which is it? Did we enter into a covenant with God saying, we will do, we will listen, showing love and devotion and commitment? Or were we stuck there with if we would have said no, we would have died right on the spot. What's going on here? Which is it? So they give different answers. I would suggest to you that the answer is this difference between obligation and responsibility. That it is true that the Torah is real, and the Torah is a reflection of God's will. And you can't have a world that will not have Torah in it. If there's no Torah in the world can't exist, because the only reason the world exists is to play out the Torah, period. And if the Jewish people don't take the Torah, the world goes back to tohu vavohu, as the Medrash says. It goes back to chaos, because it's got to happen. That's true. But then there's a relationship between the Jewish people and God that's formed by Torah. By definition, a relationship between two parties can only be when the parties willfully enter into the relationship. If you have no choice in the matter, you're not in a relationship. You're a prisoner. It may be that you should be a prisoner, but you're a prisoner, right? If your spouse ever wakes up and says, by the way, I never really had a choice, I had to say yes, okay, you're in real trouble, because what they're saying is there's no relationship here because I had no option. I had to be in, and maybe if I had a choice, I wouldn't be here, right? first they're lying to you. They really could have said yes, but that's another story. They could have said no. But my point is that that's the difference between being responsible and being obligated. The beauty of the relationship that we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Torah is that not all, even though we knew that we would die and the world itself would stop to exist if there was no Torah in it, we said, Na'aseh v'nishma. We said, I want to be responsible. And this is the key point about achrayus. The key point about achrayus is not that it's virtuous. It's not that you're a good person when you say, I want to be responsible. When Yehuda said, I'll take care of Binyamin, it wasn't that he was a good person. It was something else. It's that he said so. It's that he made himself responsible. What made Yehuda responsible for Binyamin? Nothing. Yaakov's sitting there with a problem. Binyamin is, Yosef wants Binyamin down in Egypt. Yaakov doesn't want him to go down because he's going to lose Binyamin. And Yehuda comes forward and says, I will take responsibility. What made him responsible? Nothing other than Yehuda saying, I'll be responsible. What made Yehuda responsible when he says about Tamar, said coming many? Nothing. He was obligated. He was a bad person. He did something wrong, but there was nothing that made him responsible to say that other than his statement that he said it. The point is that you're never responsible because somebody makes you responsible. If you have children, are you obligated to supervise them? Yes. Are you responsible for them? Well, that depends on you. Right? Some people have children and they're obligated to take care of them and they're not responsible. You talk to them and you say, your child broke my window, pay for it. They will pay you for it because they're obligated. But they're not responsible. They will not in any way assume responsibility. That depends on them. Only they can make themselves responsible. Right? Only we can make ourselves responsible to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We will die if we don't. But that's not responsible. That's just the reality of it. Right? The responsibility comes when we actually step forward and show the responsibility. Right? I'm just saying. The point is, sometimes responsibility gets us confused because we think responsibility means to blame. I'm not using the word responsibility as blameful. I'm using responsibility as a willful shouldering of accountability for my actions. Okay? That's all I'm saying. That's responsible. Obligation is God doesn't need me to say I'm responsible or not responsible. I'm obligated. I did something I shouldn't do. There are consequences. It has nothing to do with my attitude in the matter. It has to do only with the equation. He's God. I'm down here. He told me to do something and not to do something. I did it. There are consequences. It doesn't matter if I'm responsible or not. Right? Responsible has to do with my posture regarding the things that I do. It has nothing to do with whether or not there will be consequences. There are always consequences. A drunk does something, it happens, but he's not responsible. He's obligated, right? He's not. He doesn't take responsibility.
If he's holding this Har Sinai in front of the people, where's the choice?
Very good. We said, even though we have no choice, we're relating to it as we want to be responsible. That's the point. That's exactly the power of making this. No, he's not. We could have said, okay, we got it. We have no choice. And that would have been fine. We would have put the mountain down and wouldn't have died. We didn't say, okay, we have no choice. We said, we want to relate to this as something that we are responsible for. We actually want to be responsible for it. We want it as if it doesn't matter if we don't say yes. We want it because we want it. That's the whole point. See, here's do you like Pesach cleaning?
Do I like it?
Yeah.
To a degree.
Okay, then that's a bad example. Do you hate anything? Do you hate doing anything?
Yeah.
What do you hate doing?
Clean bathrooms.
Okay, you hate cleaning bathrooms? Why do you clean bathrooms?
They have to be clean.
They have to be clean? Why do they have to be clean?
People come in and they'll look at your bathroom and they'll
okay.
say, oh,
okay,
oh,
I know that. Okay, good. My point is that you feel obligated to clean the bathroom.
Right.
Right? Do you realize that you're not obligated to clean the bathroom? You actually want to clean your bathroom? You actually take responsibility to clean your bathroom? Right?
if you were obligated to do it, you would, after a while it would stop. The only reason you do it is because you actually believe in having a clean bathroom, right? But you act as if the only thing there is, this is a horrible, messy job that I hate to do, right? That's my point. That's obligation. Very often we don't realize that we actually are seriously committed to something, and we also find it less exciting than, I don't know, than selling roses or something like that. But the point is, there's two different levels of relationships to the things that we have to do, right? And the second level is relating to something, and owning up that I actually want to do this. I still don't like it, but I want to do this, right? I'd rather be doing something else, but I want to do this, and I believe in it because I believe in hygiene, I believe in health, I believe in business, I believe in guests being comfortable in my house. I believe in mental health and just human decency, dignity, right? So that's being responsible for something, right? But if you said, I'm only obligated to clean the bathroom because I'm stuck, who else is going to do it, whatever it is, right? And blame your husband, whatever. So then you would not be paying attention to something you actually believe in that actually is your commitment, that you want your bathroom to be clean, right? So that would be not the initial would be, I'm going to clean my bathroom because I really believe there's a benefit to it. And I really, even though I have no choice because I can't possibly consider not cleaning the bathroom, right? But I'm still owning responsibility for the fact that I want to clean my bathroom.
No one's going to kill me if I don't.
No one's going to, well, first of all, being embarrassed is worse than dying. You know that. Yeah, okay. Some people would rather die than somebody see a dirty bathroom. But anyway, yes. Yeah.
So Adam didn't accept the obligation nor the responsibility.
I think he knew that he was obligated. I think it's safe to say that he was saying that I am not, you got me. I know you're God and you saw what I did and I can't avoid that, but I'm not responsible. You know?
I'm not obligated. It's her fault. Go chase after her for the day.
But I did it. But in other words, I know that you know I did it.
Yeah, but it's not, I don't have to pay up. It's her fault.
It's not.
Okay.
I'm not obligated.
Okay. Well, I don't know if we have to argue that point. Okay. Once a person is an expert at avoiding responsibility, then he actually doesn't even get the obligation either. It could be. But there are certain times, listen, you walk off a cliff and you're crashing to the bottom and it takes you 60 seconds before you're squashed on the floor, you know that you're obligated to die because gravity obligates you to die, right? But you say, I cannot believe my mother-in-law did this to me, right? You blame it on your mother-in-law, right? It's got to be, I'll figure it out. In 60 seconds, it's got to be her fault. You know what I'm saying? I'm just saying that's how it works. Yes?
I'm not as scared yet.
Yes.
I think I differentiate obligation and responsibility.
Okay, good.
Kroger,
yeah.
9:30, 10:00 at night, a member of our congregation will go on name because she might not want to get credit for the store, is arguing with the store manager about paying for something she broke on the shelves. The store manager is telling her, you know, it's part of the overhead stuff breaks, and, you know, so at that point, it's like, you know, obligation, she broke, she means obligated to pay. And she says, you understand, but, you know, I'm such a colossus, and I don't pay attention to the way I move around the aisles, and I really need to pay for this. I mean, she really made a point of trying so hard, so much time, that was getting behind her line.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fascinated by this example,
mm-hmm.
because she was really going so far to not buy the idea stuff
break
when she was pretty clear that she broke it and she really wanted to make sure that she
broke it. Great. No, that's great. Perfect. Thank you. Okay, good. So here's a practical difference. I think that any lecture that simply highlights different points in the Torah that doesn't give you an opportunity to see how it can actually make a difference in your life, this is what really Musar is. Musar is where you actually take some practice and try to make a difference in your life. So I almost did this right now with Mrs. Karras, but let me ask you to do this. Okay, in the few minutes that we have left, I'm going to pass out these cards. There's no significance to the colors. They could be, you know what? Let's do white on this side. Blue on this side. Okay. Okay. And who needs a pen? Okay, good.
Not me.
Okay.
Does the ox have anything to do with it, the ox that's in the word?
What's that?
Ox that's in that word.
I don't know. That's a very good question, because I think the root is really acher, which is a three-letter root.
So if anyone had expected to talk about
it, yes. Right. He actually imbued us with the nature of not being responsible. By the way, it's an important point. You know, you realize this, who needs a writing implement?
So it is
this form. I'll tell you why. Well, first of all, are there anybody else? Sorry about these golf pens. This is like, what do you call it? Like putt-putt. Anybody else? Okay. All right, what I want you to do is think of an area. Let's do a religious area. Okay, you don't have to share this with anybody. This is just going to be for yourself. Think of an area in your religious life that you do because you have to, okay, that you don't even enjoy doing, something that you do in your religious life that you do because you have to, except for righteous people. There's some
just
righteous
one thing?
Yeah, start with one thing. Right now, start with one thing. Yeah. What's that? Okay. It's a big thing, right? Yeah, something that you do just because you have to. Okay, now, everybody has one? Okay. So now, let's choose one other thing. Not in your religious life. Something else that you do because you have to, that you really don't like doing. Like, it might be like, you know, cooking for Shabbos. Somebody might say that. God forbid that somebody might actually say they don't enjoy getting ready for Shabbos. But let's say somebody hates cooking for Shabbos. Here's one. Here's a really interesting one. At a certain age, changing a diaper becomes something that you do because you have to, right? When a baby is brand new, it's something you do because it's cute and it's delicious and all that kind of stuff. And wow, look how the baby makes such a nice dirty diaper. It's so beautiful. And then at a certain point, it becomes a real mess. And you really don't mind if somebody else does it.
Okay.
No, what you're saying, right? Then it goes back. Anyway, so think of something that you do because you have to. Okay? Now, alright, so now this thing, okay, these things, okay, these two things that you do, whatever they are, do you find that you do them as best as you can or as minimally as you can? Do you find that you do them to the max or do you do them as little as you can? Like, for example, today when I was at Minyan, so I did it because I had to. And the truth is, till I realized I was doing it because I had to, I was davening as little as possible. Meaning I was davening, but I was not thinking about God at all, unless necessary. Okay. Because, yeah, it is. It's also human. And I dare you to tell me it never happened to you, Peyton. Anyway.
Every morning.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so you'll see something interesting here. So, a matter of fact, what else could be done if you were doing that thing that you have to do? What else could be done beyond what you do? What else could be done that you don't do in that area that you do because you have to? If, like, cleaning the bathroom, right? Like, could you go over it another time? Could you use Mr. Clean? Could you, you know, whatever it is. Could you squeeze out the mop to make it extra hygienic? What else could you do in that area? Okay. Does everybody have an answer to that question? Spread just for your own sake. You don't have to tell me what it is. The reason I'm doing this is because you will notice that when you do something because you have to, there is obviously a tendency to do the minimum, right? There's a tendency to do less than what could be a stellar job. Now, suppose you did it because you felt responsible, like you actually willfully accept responsibility. Suppose, for example, if we're talking about cleaning the bathroom, suppose it was somebody you loved who could not clean their bathroom, and they were miserable because their bathroom was getting dirtier and dirtier. What's that?
I'd do it right away.
You'd do it right away. And you would do it better than if it was your own bathroom, because you knew what pleasure they'd get from it. Right? That is because you took responsibility. You actually, there are other things also, but you took responsibility for their bathroom, right? And all of a sudden, you were free. You were actually free to clean the bathroom. There was nothing wrong with it. You didn't care if it smelled. You didn't care if a little bit of it splattered onto your nose. Whatever it is, you would do whatever you had to do, because if somebody you loved who needed it done, they couldn't take care of it, right? And you were going to... So you were absolutely, totally committed to getting the bathroom clean, and you were being totally responsible. You took responsibility for it. They said, are you sure you could do it? Because I'd rather hire somebody, because I need somebody to really do it well. I can't stand a dirty bathroom, but I'm paralyzed, and I said, whatever it is, and I'm sick, and I can't do it. He said, don't worry, I'll do it, right? The point is that there's a tremendous amount of freedom. This is the paradox of being responsible. When a person actually takes responsibility, there's a tremendous amount of freedom. I will tell you that in that traffic accident, when I realized that I wasn't willing to deal with the fact that I was responsible, when I wrote that check to that person, I actually enjoyed it. I actually enjoyed it. I didn't love them. I didn't care about them. It wasn't that at all. I enjoyed the idea that I was taking responsibility for what I did. And I wasn't punishing myself. I wasn't self-flagellating. I was simply being responsible. And there was a tremendous amount of freedom there. I felt like a fully developed human being, right? So the point is... It's actually not what happened. That's not how it was for me. How it was for me, it was really exciting that I was being a responsible human being. I actually called the person, told them when the check would arrive. I actually did everything right. I didn't just put it in the mail and just let them get it when they get it, right? It was that kind of thing. So what I'm saying is there's a certain amount of freedom, not a certain amount of freedom, there's total freedom. The point is that most places in our lives, particularly in our religious lives, when we don't feel that, it's because we're not taking responsibility for it. We're relating to it purely as an obligation. And when we relate to something purely as an obligation, we get very constricted, very limited, and very suppressed, and we're not fully invested in what we're doing. So what I want to do, it's 9 o'clock now, I want to stop now. What we're going to do in the next two sessions is we're going to talk about how the idea of accepting achrayus, accepting responsibility, would play out in the area of finances. What does it mean to be a responsible person in the area of finances? Why is it spiritually healthy? What are the benefits? What does it look like for a person to be spiritually healthy? Is a balanced budget a Torah idea, or is that just something that people do because they want to be able to manage their money? Is paying bills a Jewish thing? What's the benefit to paying bills on time? Etc. Where does tzedakah come in? How do we relate to our possessions? That's one discussion. The second discussion I want to have is a responsibility to community. What does it mean that we're responsible for each other? What does that mean, that we're all responsible for each other? What do we mean in Judaism when we say that? Am I more responsible to another Jew who knows a lot about Judaism, or to another Jew who knows nothing about Judaism? Which am I more responsible for? Is there such a thing as partial responsibility? Is there such a thing as full responsibility? And finally, I want to talk about the whole question of responsibility in parenting. What does it mean to be a responsible parent? And how does that play out? And what are our obligations? And what are our obligations in the area of parenting? So that'll be the next two sessions. And it'll be broken down into like 3 points. Yes, Bill?
Just go back to the point of parenting in terms of the who's responsibility in terms of justice and truth. Isn't it possible that Yehuda did did not want to see him die because he knew that this would be the wrong thing, but yet he was outnumbered, and therefore there was a compromise made with his brother. So that we put him in a pit, and eventually he'll be sold, etc.
So the Reuben also didn't want to be born.
Right, okay. So the others did.
So he still covered it up.
Yes, but Bill is saying that the cover-up was the best of two deals. Either he covers up a murder or a death, or he covers up a fake a death. And so he took the best deal he could get, which might speak to a higher level of responsibility. I hear what you're saying. Got to look at that. This really is.
The Tommy Yehuda situation does bother me because he doesn't assume responsibility until Tamar shows him the garments. This is who is this?
Because he didn't know. He didn't know she was it. He didn't know that she was the prostitute.
Right, that's fine.
Right. Then, the second he gets confronted with the fact that he was involved with this woman, is the woman that he was involved with, at that point, he publicly acknowledges it. You know, the first moment that he knows. Yeah. I mean,
what did he think she was when he went and confronted
her? He didn't care.
He thought it was his daughter-in-law who had committed adultery of some sort. Some type. He didn't think she was a prostitute. He knew this was Zansa Tamar Kalasecha. Your daughter-in-law has committed adultery. That's what he thought. And now he's sitting in judgment. And then he realizes, oh my gosh, this is a woman who I related to as a prostitute, and she was actually doing this on purpose for me. And I'm the one. I actually, So he went and publicly acknowledged it. Yeah. That's by the way, that's not only is in the merit of that kind of thing, that actually leads to the actual royal line straight out of Tamar. It's amazing. All right. Thanks for your attention. Thanks for being here. All right. And if you have any suggestions or your suggestions is a nice word, or criticisms, I will welcome them. So please call me, leave it on voicemail, send me an email, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.